This is Tim Hinton. I'm adding this extra introduction because on the afternoon that this podcast was to be released, we learned that Mike McCool, one of the guests on this recording, has just passed away after a sudden and unexpected illness. Our thoughts and prayers go out to his family and loved ones. His friends who were on this podcast with him shared with me that this conversation, recorded about a month ago, has taken on a special significance because of this coincidence. And we at the Marching Roundtable are happy that we could facilitate this conversation among friends about the Great Velvet Nights. Mike was a hilarious and generous man who always kept his friends and colleagues laughing, and I know you'll enjoy hearing Mike on this recording. The podcast is full of surprising stories and a lot of laughter. There's no question that much of the humor and fun that we all loved about the Velvet Nights came directly from the quick mind and personality of Mike McCool. So, thanks, Mike, for all the laughs, the great entertainment, and all that you gave to the Drum Corps community. You will be greatly missed. Thank you for listening to this special introduction, and now here's part one of our conversation. This podcast is sponsored by Creative Solutions, found at creativemarchingsolutions.com. The Velvet Nights were a crowd favorite year after year in the 80s and 90s, and they changed Drum Corps forever. On the next three podcasts, we bring together many of those who were instrumental in creating that unique VK identity. You'll want to hear the entire conversation in all three parts, which starts here with the fascinating origins of the Corps, which grew from a very successful and experimental Winter Guard, and from a lot of initial inexperience.
We had less than no experience. We didn't have any idea what we were going to do, where we were. All we knew was that we wanted to do something, and we wanted to do something big. It was absolutely about, hey, man, let's put something together that they can be proud of and something that makes them happy to wear their Corps jacket around, and something that when people are talking about a thing that they're in, they're talking about how great it is.
You'll love hearing about the sequence of events that led to the all-important identity change for the Drum Corps. And the way this happens is not at all what you would guess it would be.
We're sitting in a meeting, and two questions that forever changed the destiny of the VK happened. One of the first questions Roger asked was, what are our goals this year? What is our goal? Mike looked at him and said, the goal is when the Corps comes on the field, that the crowd doesn't go run to get a hot dog and a Coke. And that would frame that answer to that question. And it was funny as heck at the time that he said it, that how are we going to talk about competition when we really got to establish a couple things here?
The decisions made at this one meeting led not only to the identity of the Corps, but also to the creation of the uniform, another story you will not believe. And there's also the incredibly important role that Bobby Hoffman played in all of this.
One of Bobby's biggest pet peeves was that there's so much copying in drum corps, in marching band. And you know what? It's kind of true to any industry. Whoever the leaders are, that's who people are going to follow. Right. That's who people are going to copy. So that's not too far left. So there we are, and it's 82, and we not only have an identity, but we're starting to bring signatures in and give the Corps other things to do that can distinguish them on a football field.
You will love hearing these great stories of the origin of this identity, the look, and the style of the Corps. Part one of our conversation about the Velvet Nights on the Marching Roundtable. This podcast is sponsored by Creative Solutions, found at creativemarchingsolutions.com. Creative Solutions offers all-inclusive audio-visual productions for marching band, indoor percussion, and winter guard groups. Every show is affordable, regionally protected, and easily customized to a group's specific needs. For more information, visit creativemarchingsolutions.com. We're always really happy when we can be the venue for a group of old friends and colleagues to get together to discuss old times that they loved. We begin this podcast in the middle of a conversation with a group that obviously cares much for each other and share a lot of common history.
Yeah.
Okay, so Gary, you put this together. Do you have anything you want to say to them or to me before we begin?
Well, what started the whole thing is, believe it or not, Tim, I've actually listened to every podcast except a couple that are in my queue right now. But
well, thank you.
Back a couple of months ago, there was one for those keeping scores, number 334, with Byron Valentine and Derek Smith, and they're talking about happy guard shows and how every guard show doesn't have to be a big production, a big serious thing, and why not go out and have fun once in a while? And I thought, well, heck, we did that on the field for how many years while we talked about in the drum corps situation. And I just thought of all you guys and said, you know, why don't we get together and have a chat with Tim and see where it goes?
Well, I love that because, Gary, a lot of people don't know that we're always looking for suggestions for podcast topics or guests. And you sort of pitched this to me, and I thought it was an awesome idea. So you sort of got this crew together.
Yeah. And, you know, I thought of the best people that would have, you know, once somebody on here is going to be fun and entertaining and have a good sense of humor. And every one of these people fits that bill, that's for sure.
Except for Chip. Yeah, I ride on your guys' coattails.
Yeah.
I'm good 20 material.
Yeah.
We have on the line, Gary, you got this crowd together. So first I'll just say hello to everybody. On the line tonight with us is Matt Savage. Matt, how are you?
Excellent.
Thank you for being here. Also, Roxanne Narachi. Did I say that right, Roxanne?
Yes, you did.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Right.
Hey, then, where is everybody at? Let's give their locations, too, because that's fun.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, all right, good. Well, then Greg Clark and Mike McCool, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Great.
And I introduced you together because you're sharing a mic on a computer tonight. So, Mike and Greg, where are you guys?
Roswell, New Mexico.
We're at my house.
Sorry.
We're about a block and a half away from the UFO Museum at my house.
Really?
Yeah. This is the McCool Rehab Ranch in Roswell, Mexico. And this is Greg's first visit to the ranch. And we're just getting his papers ready and getting him checked in. We're all good.
And we've been talking about this rendezvous here for
30 years.
The better part of 30 years.
Uh-huh. Wow. So you guys made this happen. It's all your fault.
This is great.
Seriously, see, you seriously got together because of this podcast?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Wow, look at that. Marching roundtable, bringing people together.
Yeah, bringing people together.
Yeah.
All right, so Gary, I tell you, well, Gary, where are you?
Well, I just got back to Southern California. I live in Redlands, which is east of Los Angeles, after 11 years in Las Vegas.
Oh, all right. Well, welcome back to California, I suppose.
It's good to be home, yeah.
Roxanne, where are you calling us from?
Well, I reside in Long Beach, but right now I'm in Torrance in my classroom. It's at a middle school.
Here we are. So you're still at school. Thank you.
Yeah.
And then, Matt, where are you?
I'm in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, in our little cottage. I'm in my drum room, or our drum room, my wife and Amy, sitting in the woods.
He's in Chapel Hill,
North Carolina.
Wait a minute.
Yeah,
Chapel Hill. That's
the hill of
Chapel. Great.
All right, so Matt, do you want to explain why we keep hearing that they keep calling you Chip?
Chip. Well, first, somehow my nickname got to be Chip Chip or Chip Cheese or Chim Chimmery, and I, to the life of me, I can't remember how or why. I know it was Greg Clark, but I don't know how it happened. Like most things that come about.
I blame Greg Clark as well.
Greg, do you remember? It was probably just...
It was probably him just playing drums with his fingers going chip, 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 chip. See, out of all of us, Chip is the first one that was a living, breathing, professional instructor. Like somebody that knew what they were doing, knew coming in, hey, I got a plan. This is how you do... the rest of us, we were merely playing. We were trying to figure out what was going on. We got Chip, and he got our Chip into line quickly because he knew what was happening. He knew what was going on. He had a plan. He executed that plan, and we were just all so amazed to be working with somebody so good that we had to give him a name. Chip, Chip.
Well, that, quite honestly, all these years later, I bet it did come from a – a warm-up exercise out of the drum line.
Yeah, see?
Yeah.
See?
Chip, and chip. We're continually volleying heat into each other's court, and chip, 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 just happened to evolve into something.
Yeah.
And you know what, Tim?
Yes?
I just wanted to say, having this group together is awesome. And there were so many people over the years that contributed so mightily to what we achieved over the years and the absolute glorious memories that we got. And I know when you put a few people on the phone line together, it starts to become number prohibitive. But people like Dr. Greg Wall, Charlie Grubb, Dave Elder, Sandy Mercadante, Robbie Carson, Bill Park. I'm just thinking off the top of my head here about when we first started around the 80s, the early 80s, before we got the new uniform or anything.
Yep.
Those people were a mighty part of it, and this conversation is missing them, and we're going to try and do it justice without them.
Uh-huh. Well said.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think what would be helpful to me is I would love to know what each of you did with the Velvet Knights, what your sort of role was or how you were involved and sort of when that happened. So first off, I'll just ask Gary, since you put this crowd together, were all of these people there at the same time, I'm assuming?
Yeah, pretty much. Roxanne, when did you march in the garden? When did you make the transition to instructor?
I marched and taught at the same time in 82. Well, I taught in 81 and then I marched and taught in 82.
Yeah, that's
right. I taught 83, 84, 87, 88, whatever.
Let's go back a little bit. And basically the Corps came out of the 70s, and they were struggling a little bit. And so what happened is a bunch of people got together and said, you know, why don't we just kind of rebrand this thing? And so the Corps took a year off in 1980. We did a lot of parades, including the Grand Tour de Lompoc, which Mike can tell you a little bit more about. Since that was his battle cry that year. And then decided to, let's see what we can do about putting the Corps back in the field in 1981. Well, in the meantime, in 1980, we got this great group of young kids together. A lot of them had never done drum corps before. As a matter of fact, the majority had never done drum corps before. But they kind of believed us, and they kind of bought into the whole thing, and they really dedicated themselves, and they worked really hard. So we brought the Corps back out in 1981, after that year off. And in that time, we'd also been able to put together, Mike and Greg had already been there working with the Color Guard, I believe. Is that right, Mike and Greg?
Yeah.
Okay. So they were on the team. We brought in a couple of alumni to help out. We brought in actually a couple of people, including Mike, that came from the Anaheim Kingsmen, which you would think, you know, after the big rivalry for so many years, why would so many people from the Kingsmen come work with VK? They saw an opportunity and a great opportunity not only to help a corps, but also to work together again. And, you know, just make something special. And that's kind of was the thing that got everything going. Now, I was a VK alumni. There was a couple of other alumni that came and helped out, but that's pretty much where it all started. And then from there, it just kind of gained steam, and we just kind of kept bringing in more people. And I think when the Corps finally made finals, there's only about 10 people who had either aged out or didn't march Corps anymore. The rest of them stuck it out.
Yeah, you know, the whole origin story to me is kind of interesting in that it was such an unlikely thing to ever happen.
It was an auspicious beginning. After the 78 drum corps season, myself and a few friends from the Bridgemen moved to Southern California. No intention, just to get away from New Jersey and take a break. One of the people that went with us was Sandy Van Romer. She was from the Bridgemen, and she had a gig with the Velvet Knights Winter Guard. Tim Moxley had asked her to teach, and she was doing that. She asked me, Greg, do you want to teach the Winter Guard with us? I said, I've never even thought of the concept of teaching a Winter Guard. I don't even like Winter Guard that much. She said, no, come on. You can teach marching. You can teach the flag line. I'll give you the exercises. Whatever you want to do, come on and do it with us. I got hired. Sandy Van Romer was the person that got me my first gig.
Greg,
with
have you
Tim.
Ever spun flags or anything like that?
Never.
Okay.
And never taught marching, never spun flags, never done anything.
She's never done any of that?
Nope. And Sandy said, I'll give you the exercises. But as this whole thing evolved there was always a couple people in the line that were stronger. They did the real teaching. They did most of the work. So we did that, and that Winter Guard season, it was an adventure, absolutely an adventure. After that Winter Guard season, um, I went back and marched in Bayonne in 1979, and that was my age-out year. At the end of that year, Jack Bevins came up to me and said, "Do you want to do the guard?" Now, they needed an all-new staff, and I said, "I don't know. What do you want?" He was basically saying, "Here's the Winter Guard. Get some instructors. Do this thing." And I wasn't sure. I was overwhelmed at the thought of having such little experience and you're responsible for this whole thing. I went and talked to my good friend Ty Tyler's mother. She was with the Kingsmen. He was with the Kingsmen. He had also marched in Bayonne. And she was a friend and a know-all. And I sat down and I said, "I got this offer to do the VK, the Comp Guard again, and then the Corps. And who in the heck am I going to get? Who am I going to do this with? I'm not even sure I want to do it." And that's when she said, "Get Mike McCool. Get Mike McCool. He marched in the Kingsmen. He knows how to teach marching, and I'll set it up." From there, that's when things got going, because that's when I knew I wanted to do it. And that's when we moved on, and fate took over from there.
Basically, the way that I remember it, and like I said, I am definitely not changing any names because nobody's innocent. And I also am playing fast and loose with all the facts, just so everybody knows. So, I went to a party at a mutual friend's house, and we were just hanging out. Somebody, they had a big house. We used to hang out and this guy walks up to me. I have no idea who he is. I'd never seen him before in my life. And he says to me, "Hey, man, I hear you write some drill." And I said, "This is 1979. I said, "Hey, yeah, I write some drill." And he goes, "Well, that's far out, man. I'm going to do the VK Winter Guard. You want to do it with me?" And I have no idea what possessed me or what I was thinking, but I said, "Yeah, let's do that." And that was the beginning of it. That's the day that I met Greg. That's the day that our lives changed. And that's the first day of this process, that the first step of it basically ended at DCI in 1984. We went a couple days later to the Corps director's house, Jack Bevins. I had seen him around because his daughter had marched with me in the Anaheim Kingsmen. So I had seen Jack. Jack had spent some time on tour in 74 with the Kingsmen. I knew who he was. I knew he was the director of the Velvet Knights. And we go over, we meet at his house, and basically sit down in his living room. And he just starts talking to us and asking us, you know, what our plans were, what we had in mind, this and that. And he also had another alumni and instructor for the Corps with him, Gary Lee. And I don't remember anything that Jack said, but I remember exactly what Gary Lee said. He looked at us in the eye, both Greg and I, and said, "Will it win?" And I looked at Greg and I said, "Yes, it will win." and they hired us right then and there. And then Greg and I left, and I looked at Greg and I said, "Greg, will it win?" Greg and I had less than no experience. We didn't have any idea what we were going to do, where we were. All we knew was that we wanted to do something, and we wanted to do something big. We wanted to do something that could affect people. We wanted to take something, somebody, anybody, and
do something that could possibly change lives and possibly to me, it was more about there was already a group of people at the Velvet Knights. It was more about allowing those people that were there to be able to be great at something than anything personal or anything, any object or any score or placement or anything. It was absolutely about, hey man, let's put something together that they can be proud of and something that makes them happy to wear their core jacket around, and something that when people are talking about a thing that they're in, they're talking about how great it is. And that from day one kind of was our credo. About anything else came as a byproduct of, let's do something that the kids can be great at, and let's do something that they can be proud of being in. So that was kind of the very beginning. And that was the first step on how it all began.
And Tim, this is Greg Clark talking.
Yeah.
I can't emphasize enough how young Mike and I were at this moment and how absolutely thrilled and delighted we were to be getting a gig. Basically, we have no experience, and we've just been given a job. Here's a winter color guard, create something. Here's a drum corps, make it better than it was. And we walk out of that meeting, and I go, Mike, you told the guy it's going to win? Have you lost your mind? We have never done anything. We haven't lost. We haven't done anything in the middle. How's it going to win? He said, it's going to win. I said, great. And from that time on, the Winter Guard is where the core came from. If there was ever the proverbial cart before the horse, the Winter Guard was going a couple years, a couple seasons prior to the core getting some legs and starting to build to obviously that culmination in 84 when we first made finals. So it's interesting when you look back 30 years later and you're talking about, well, how did this happen? How did this core change its identity? How did it become successful? And it was incremental. It did take a leap every year until it got to the finals, and then we kept going. And when I look back, I think there were some seminal moments, especially after the Color Guard had been going a couple years, and the Color Guard was really the antithesis of what the core became. The core was light and lively, Southern California, laid back, fun and games within a drum corps context. And the Winter Guard was more esoteric, yeah, way out there, weird. And I got to tell you, because of our experience level was so nil, that when I say weird, I mean that literally, figuratively, and spiritually, because when you don't know what you're doing, a good way to mask that, or at least cover it up and give you a little bit more time to get your act together, weird works. Weird worked for us. And we tried to be stranger and stranger and stranger and not be what the norm was.
Yeah, it was much more an art project with the Winter Guard than anything else. It was much more about you have to take Color Guard as it existed then and definitely put it through a filter of people that don't know anything about it, just thought it was cool, and then re-put that product onto the floor. And so, of course, it's going to be different than what people are doing. We came to a point with the Winter Guard where, I mean, it's kind of a famous point to Greg and I when, Roxanne was so important in that she had Color Guard background and Greg and I didn't. She had performance background and Greg and I didn't. And she knew about the nuts and bolts of putting it together. And as a member, she was the first person that kind of bought in and wanted to become part of our act. We always called it an act, and wanted to be part of that. And so that's why, even though she went on to teach for years and years, longer than both Greg and I taught, actually, but it's she's such an important person to us and to the Velvet Knights, because she was the first person that said, with any experience, that said, yeah, I could do this. This might be cool. And so that was a big turning point for us, because up till then, we were just laughing today about this, Greg and I. We used to, for rehearsal, for Winter Guard rehearsal, Greg and I would get in the car and have to go pick up half the Color Guard at their houses. Because, first of all, they were young, and second of all, they weren't really sure. They weren't even going to commit gas money to being in that Color Guard yet, because they didn't know us. They didn't know, is this the one that's going to be good? Is, you know, they had a few guards before that with a few groups of staff that had been had promised them pie in the sky, and they really hadn't succeeded. So they were very wary about their color guard, and it was definitely a trust thing in the very beginning. I remember the very first rehearsal of talking to, I don't know if there was 15, 16 kids there, and they all had a look on, like, this is the third group of people in the last 3 years that have told us it's going to be good. And so Greg and I stopped right then and said, you know what? We don't know. We just know this. It's going to be different, and it's going to be memorable.
And it's an interesting segue as we certainly crescendo up to 84 and how this happened with the Corps. There was a couple seminal moments, and one I remember distinctly, like it was yesterday, because it was embarrassing, is after the Color Guard had found some success and some notoriety, and people were beginning to like them, and they were getting a nationwide presence. At the end of 1982, we went to a critique at the end of the year, and competitively, they were doing real well, too. And we were feeling good about it. Mike and I had been around a couple seasons. We were starting to not look ignorant, not look
foolish.
Foolish. And at one of the critiques, the judges basically, and this was a heavy set of judges, or a set of heavy judges, excuse me.
I think I just decoded that.
We were basically told by the judges this night in 82, your performers are a lot better than your staff. And it was a humbling moment, because we were just starting to feel good about ourselves.
And so, there was no bones about it. This wasn't, oh, you talent. You got a lot of talent this year. It was, those kids, they are way better than you are.
And at that moment, so we finished that season, and we came right out of that thinking, we need to up the game. We need to raise the level of the show design, raise the level of our contribution to such. So we decided to hire Stanley Knob, who was a movement pioneer in the Color Guard and the Drum Corps activity, and who we already had a relationship with. And we just decided to upgrade the Winter Guard there.
Yeah, that's when we decided that it was kind of a switch went off of, hey, it's about time we started getting some experts involved. And we brought in
Karen Doyle
from the East Coast to do the Saber line. We brought in Stanley to bring in a whole different dimension with movement and dance and that whole thing. We were finally at that point willing to kind of open up the umbrella a little bit and say, hey man, let's find like-minded people that we can do with this. And that kind of dovetails with Matt coming in with the drum corps.
Before we jump with Matt adding in, I do want to go to Roxanne. Roxanne, you were there during this process they just described, right, as a marching member?
Yes.
And then ultimately as an important marching member and then as a transitioning to a staff member. So do you want to speak at all to what they were saying about you deciding to buy in? How did that happen for you?
I don't remember. It's bad. No, I was marching with a lot of other color guards prior to this. And it was like, you know, it was in a lot of people's minds are like, why are you going to go march VK? That's like, you know, a step down because I had done – I'd marched with Night Raiders with Dave Bandy, and we were up there with Seattle Imperials and, you know, just with some other color guards that were – I mean, Anaheim Kingsman Winter Guard was really good, and I'd marched with Freelancers. I marched with all these other groups, and they were like, why are you going to go to VK? And I couldn't really answer that. I just believed in Mike and Greg, and I was ready to have fun. I don't know.
I think the distinction in talking about Roxanne is – the VK at that time, when we got there, had a core of performers that were solid and would have bought in no matter who stood in front of them at that point because exactly. They loved the core that much. The yeah. part where Roxanne came in, Roxanne was an outsider, and she was an outsider with credibility. And so when she came in, she was basically endorsing the staff because she had been with really good staffs before, and she was endorsing the guard. Right. So it was twofold,
right.
and it made a big impact spiritually. Now, as we crescendo up to finals here, we're still in 82, and the color guard is established and weird as hell and competitively doing well. And at the end of that season, we had that epiphany, which was told to us by judges, that basically the staff wasn't good, but the performers are just awesome.
Right.
So we move from there and we go right into the Memorial Day camp and for drum corps. And a couple things happened that weekend. The corps did not have a changed identity. We had not had meetings about, boy, let's make this thing fun. We had not had meetings about how to make this 10 different other things. It just hadn't happened. I mean, this was all part of the progression, and this is where it got fun. This is where the identity change, you can term it as, it was a reaction. So that weekend, it's at the last day, they're doing run-throughs, and somebody had sewn together a blouse and put it on a drummer as they were doing the final run-throughs.
Name names.
Now, because...
I'll name names. You want me to name names?
Mike would like to dip in for a
second. No, this is, I'm not pointing the finger to anybody. Robbie Carson was part of the drum staff at that time. Robbie Carson is... Well, you know Robbie Carson. He's more famous than all of us put together. He's a very, very brilliant musician. He's a serious, serious, at that time, young man. He had a dream of putting his own drumline onto the field for some, making it into something that was brilliant. But his idea was 180 degrees different than the idea that Greg and I were trying to develop.
So basically, we're in the final run-through, and here's this blouse on a drummer with the rest of a corps that's in street clothes, and the corps is good at this point. The 82 corps was a solid drum corps in most all sections. So we're up there looking at this, and obviously... the visual staff, nobody even close to the visual staff, had put in this blouse together. So now they finish their run through, and we go right to a meeting with the then show coordinator, who was Roger Olson. We're sitting in a meeting, and two questions that forever changed the destiny of the VK happened in this meeting. One of the first questions Roger asked was, What are our goals this year? What is our goal? And obviously, anytime anybody talks about that, it's let's talk competition. Let's talk what place we want to get. Let's go for it here. And before anybody could even think about the question, Mike looked at him and said, The goal is when the core comes on the field that the crowd doesn't go run to get a hot dog and a Coke. And that would frame that answer to that question, and it was funny as heck at the time that he said it, that how are we going to talk about competition when we really got to establish a couple things here?
Yeah, what we were after was the same thing that we had already started to turn with the color guard. I wanted to be able to do with the entire drum corps. I wanted a kid that wore a VK t-shirt for people to walk up to him and say, "Wow, man, you're in the VK. How cool." Or, "Are you good enough to be in the VK? Wow, man, you must really be able to play." Or, "I love them." Instead of being like the stepsister in town, or, "Hey, drum corps, isn't that what the Blue Devils in Santa Clara do?" Or stuff like that. I wanted these kids, these members, I was the kid, but I wanted these people to be able to have their own identity and for it to be something that was great. Something they could be proud of, something that could blow people away with.
And at that moment, we had no clue of what was going on that court at that point from a visual standpoint, from a uniform standpoint, costume, identity. We weren't there. But the next question changed that fate also. Roger said, "So, what did you think of the new blouse?" And it was absolute bedlam. It was absolute heckling from all of us, starting with Mike, and then we all just took his lead and rolled with it. And it was probably as a result of Robbie Carson's proactive, "Check this out, let's get this going," and our unpreparedness for that moment that changed it, because after we were done heckling,
we realized we had to have a strong reaction.
And
we couldn't just say, "That stinks. What's your idea?" "I don't know."
Roger Olson looked at me and said, "You got 24 hours. And if you don't have anything better in 24 hours, believe me, you'll be wearing that." And that's what changed it. In the next 24 hours, we put Charlie Gros' Vietnam khaki pants together. We went to the material store next to the bingo hall of the Velvet Knights, bought material that wasn't the wildest, most beautiful looking material, but within that 24-hour time frame, we had that sewn into a shirt, we got a straw hat, and we got a pair of Vans tennis shoes and said, "This is it. This is Southern California. We'll figure it out from there." And that's the birth of a new drum corps, the birth of a new identity. It would sound really wise at this moment, 30 years later, to say, "Man, we had some really creative sessions to where we were just talking about the most fertile identity." It was none of that.
Yeah, what
it was a knee-jerk, reach-birth reaction.
What it came down to was this. So we have this ultimatum. You have 24 hours. And so I grab Jack and say, "Jack, give us a budget, man. We're looking at uniforms for 128 people." And he says, "All right, let me think. He goes in his back pocket. He goes in his back pocket. He's looking at his, he always kept his bills in his right pocket and his change in his left pocket. And he says, $2,200. And I look at Greg and say, "Greg, $2,200. We can go to Hollywood and get them dressed. Let's just drive. We'll go tomorrow morning. We'll go to a costume shop in Hollywood for $2,200 a piece." Jack said, "Oh, no. No, that's $2,200 total.
Total. Exactly.
For the entire drum corps. Yeah, for the entire drum corps." I said, "Uh-oh. Plan B." So that's when Greg went to Charlie's house and said, "Okay, I need a neutral pant." Charlie goes, "I got your neutral pant." Puts on these khakis. All right. So we go, like I said, next door to the bingo hall and said, "All right, we need a material that's kind of has a Southern California flair." And believe me, this is two people that don't know much about material. And we need a Southern California flair that we're going to make costumes for about 150 people. And though that pattern, that red Hawaiian shirt is the only material they had that much of. That's why it was that.
And it had red in it because we needed
exactly.
Red.
Yeah, because we. I mean, so you know, these were not high level decisions. This was the guns pointed at your head. What are you going to do?
Yep.
That's amazing. I never even knew that story.
I'm having a hard time believing that something so brilliant and iconic happened in this way.
Yeah, but you know, most of history is done in hindsight when you can articulate it.
We're standing
here 30 years later, and it's clear as a bell. I mean, your hindsight's about the only thing I don't need my reading glasses for. And when you talk about getting to this point, now we got some.
Yeah.
I mean, the Winter Guard was the same way. Mike and I didn't have a clue, and we have all these people giving input and having ideas. We wanted a mohawk. I took the tinsel off my Christmas tree and put it on a uniform, and I said, there's our mohawk. And if you look at the 83 comp guard from the VK.
They're wearing his tinsel.
They were a good color guard. They're wearing the tinsel. It was the next year, in 1984, that we put a bow on them, and we finally had a costume that was beautiful. And that came from people with no experience.
Yeah.
It came from a bunch of us. The buy-in by that point was awesome. And so now you're at 82 with the drum corps, and you talk about something that's so cool in hindsight.
Yeah, it could have blown up right then, because the next day at Memorial Day camp, all of a sudden we dressed a kid in the uniform. Here's the Hawaiian shirt, here's the pants, here's the straw hat, here's the Van t-shirt. Now we got to go tell this entire drum corps, guess what, this is your uniform, quote unquote. They had no idea it was coming. They had no idea. So in conjunction with that, Greg and I Greg, I'm not exactly sure who had the idea or where it came from.
Here we go.
But Greg and I, on a different field, totally away from the drum corps, probably right behind the field the corps was practicing on, had an idea, and we wanted to work it out before we started putting it on the field. So for some reason, we decided we better not do this thing in front of the drum corps because it could be the dumbest thing that's ever. So we have – Greg, tell them about the
– we have the drum major, which was Jeff Burnham, God rest his soul. And we have a shark fin that we taped to a lunch tray. And we took 40 feet of monofilament and tied it to Jeff's belt.
And told him, run.
And it was a moment that's crystal clear right now. And we basically trashed the drum corps rehearsal because everybody on the field 100 yards away stopped and was turned around and was looking at it because it was a moment. It was a moment where you knew you have an unexpected surprise that's going to slam dunk people.
When the kids in the corps started to laugh, it was almost like it was the most unexpected thing. It was I can't explain how much of a validation that this thing that so far had been going for 2 years was, because the kids, they're looking, and why is Jeff running? Shark. Oh, my. These guys are nuts.
It wasn't the right color. It wasn't the right size. None of it was right.
The entire corps lost it. They were falling down laughing. And Greg and I looked at each other and said, yeah, this might work out. So it was right after that when we sprung the uniform on them. And they were in. They were in 200%.
That's brilliant.
I was going to say that, you know, in 82 – when we were in the Winter Guard before this, in 81, there was, you know, some of the kids from Winter Guard marched the Corps. In 82, we had to march the Corps if we were going to march in the Winter Guard. And we had really a lot of talent in two Winter Guards, actually.
Yeah.
And because we had to march in the Drum Corps, there was this huge color guard, which brought in a lot of horn players and brought in a lot of people. But we were like the impetus of the Corps. And so – like we believed in Mike and Greg. We were the drum corps. The color guard and Mike and Greg were the drum corps. So no matter what anybody wanted to do, we were going to make it happen because we, you know, they had us 100%, and we were the drum corps, really. And then so after that, everything just generated from there.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden, the Winter Guard has picked up so much momentum, and now the corps, 60, 70, 80 people are showing up in the stands. And now all of a sudden, by 1982, the corps is doing an exhibition intermittently two or three times during the season. Now all of a sudden, there's a vacuum.
Right, the word's
starting out. Now all of a sudden, there's some momentum. I had just finished marching with the Bridgemen in 79 when I came out to Southern California and Mike and I hooked up. The commonality between Mike and I 30 years later is Bobby Hoffman was the taught the Anaheim Kingsmen, one of the more cadet-styled corps ever, and he was also the show coordinator of the Bridgemen. When I marched with the Bridgemen, Bobby Hoffman was a rock star, but the people in the corps felt like they were the rock stars because we were loved and applauded so vigorously during the 3 years that I was there and every year that I ever saw him after that, that it was something that you don't forget.
Right.
So now all of a sudden, Mike and I are starting to have these conversations because, the VK has an identity and how best to support that and bring that thing to life other than signatures like this and doing things that nobody else was doing. One of Bobby's biggest pet peeves was that there's so much copying in drum corps, in marching band. And you know what? It's kind of true to any industry. Whoever the leaders are, that's who people are going to follow. Right. That's who people are going to copy. So that's not too far left. So there we are, and it's 82, and we not only have an identity, but we're starting to bring signatures in and give the Corps other things to do that can distinguish them on a football field.
We continue this conversation on the next two podcasts. First, we talk about the development of the Corps once the new identity had been created, where some of the famous ideas were developed, like that famous shark fin, and the origin of the beach balls in the stands. On the third podcast, we talk about the development of the Corps, which led to those very famous shows in 1987 and 1988, with more stories that you will not believe. Thanks again to our sponsor, Creative Solutions, found at creativemarchingsolutions.com. And thanks to you for listening. Make sure and listen to the rest of this conversation on the next two podcasts. The Marching Roundtable now has over 1,000 VIP members, listeners, and fans who are following our podcasts closely. If you or your company sponsor one of our podcasts, you'll have the ears of these listeners and many more like them who download thousands of podcasts each month, hearing your sponsor message. These listeners also could see your ad on every page of our website, plus see your company name and a link to your website on our bi-weekly newsletter or where our podcasts are located. Find out more by clicking on Sponsorship Opportunities at our website at marchingroundtable.com or contact Tim at tim@marchingroundtable.com. Our listeners are the exact audience you're trying to reach.